Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Brian J. Rowan, the host of the Film Stage Show and the Film Stage Roundtable, and I'm here today with a special presentation for you. I had the opportunity to interview David Ferrier, one of the co-directors of the documentary Tickled, which we talked about a few weeks ago on this podcast, and I was able to get an interview with him that we were able to record and publish to you fine folks for your listening pleasure. So take a listen. We go over some of the technical aspects of making the film, as well as some of the more, shall we say, esoteric impacts that this film has had on David and his team. So I hope you really like it. Don't forget to follow the show on Twitter at Film Stage Show. Follow us on Facebook, The Film Stage Show. And as always, comment and rate on iTunes. Here is the interview with David Ferrier. So yes, here live with the director, or one of the directors, I should say, and perhaps the protagonist of the documentary Tickled, David Ferrier.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. I have to say, I watched this movie with my wife, and what began as kind of a light chuckle very, very rapidly turned into slack-jawed stares and a complete and utter sense of bafflement. So I want to try to understand how you went about making this movie, because it starts from a very innocent place. You send an email or a Facebook message just asking for a little more information about competitive endurance tickling, and things very quickly go out of the rails beyond there. So
yeah, I mean, it still feels baffling to me as well, by the way.
Okay, good. Because I was going to ask, was there ever a point in the grand journey that you went on where it started to feel real, or did it always have a sort of sheen of unbelievability for you?
Oh, no, it still seems unbelievable. I mean, you know, everything that's happened since we've put the documentary out seems unbelievable. You know, we've had people from Dana Bryan Media who make these competitive tickling videos turning up to screenings, and just the strangest sort of things happening. And, you know, I'm reading, you know, tweets and stuff saying, you know, the film's fake and that we've got this amazing marketing scheme going on. So obviously I'm not alone in kind of thinking this is all pretty strange. But, you know, there are moments of it being very real. I mean, very early on, you know, the first response I got from Jane O'Brien Media when I sort of wanted to do a story was, we don't want to deal with a homosexual journalist. That was strange and odd. But, you know, then we started, you know, Dylan and I, who I made this film with, started sort of blogging about the company as we started interacting with them. And then, you know, we got letters from lawyers, and that seemed a little bit more real. And then I think when it hit home and when we knew we had a film, was when they flew three people from America to New Zealand to sort of mediate with us. And I guess they wanted conversations, and sort of they wanted to tell us why this wasn't worthy of a documentary and why we shouldn't make it. So that's when, you know, and it was surreal, but it also was very real at the same time.
Now, you mentioned them sending lawyers letters and flying people out to meet you. One of the things that my colleagues and I said when we were watching the film is that this is a very deep conspiracy, and they seem to be trying really hard to stay hidden on paper, but every action that they took is not the action of someone who doesn't want attention brought to them.
No, yeah, and I'm still struggling with that, because, you know, you're right, everything they did brought attention to them. If they'd just, you know, replied on Facebook saying we're a bit busy today, then, you know, I would have probably, I was in a newsroom with, you know, I needed to turn out stories daily, so I would have just moved on to something else. You know, and then they practically, you know, flew three, you know, of our subjects to New Zealand to my, you know, I didn't even have to book a plane ticket to go to America. You know, they came to us. So, and, you know, since the film, you know, we've had the main, yeah, character's probably not the right word, but, you know, we've had one of the main subjects turn up, you know, very publicly, and threaten us with more legal action in front of a whole cinema full of people and cameras. And, you know, we're live streaming that whole thing.
Right.
So it's, there's a very, you know, and the people in this film, you know, it's got a history, and they definitely want to be hidden. But at the same time, I don't know, maybe, I think since maybe they've been exposed in the film, even since that, they've kind of just gone, okay, we're out there, so we're going to be a bit more public about things. But early on, you know, there were certain people hiding and certain people being, you know, in the open about it to sort of threaten us and put us off making the film. So it's been a real confusing combination.
I believe it. I mean, was there ever a moment in the filming of this documentary and all of your research and all of your travels that you felt in any way, like, physically unsafe? Because there's definitely a 70s conspiracy kind of feel to everything. The only thing that was missing was someone breaking into your hotel room to try to kill you.
I should clarify right out there, you know, we're all fine and we are safe. I think, you know, a lot of the threats come down to legal threats and, you know, being sued and that sort of thing. But there were moments making it, of course. You know, when these three gentlemen came to New Zealand, they originally wanted to be in a hotel room. And, you know, that made me uneasy. So we ended up meeting in a boardroom. You know, I didn't want to meet three people from this company that was, you know, already threatening me with legal action. I didn't want to meet them alone in a room. And, you know, there was a moment in the film where we were traveling to, you know, meet an MMA fighter who we didn't know whether it was a trap or whether he was on our side. And, you know, this aspect was a sort of a line that didn't come through in the film because it was just a sort of a side point. But when we were going there, I mean, we were literally going to a town of MMA fighters. We didn't know whether they were with, with the Jane Rowan media or sort of they actually wanted to talk to us. So there were moments when we did feel unsafe for sure. But, you know, we're alive. We're well.
I'm very glad to hear that. Now, just let us know, from the moment you sent that first email or Facebook message to the moment where you sort of wrapped filming and editing, how long was that process?
Oh, it was about a year, probably 18 months, I'd say.
Okay.
So it wasn't long.
Research and going out.
Yeah, shooting. And, you know, we had our, you know, we started in 2014 and we were in, you know, we had it for 2016 Sundance, probably had it finished a couple of months before that. So, you know, it was a pretty quick turnaround, but it's just because it started so quickly, you know, from finding that competitive endurance tackling was a thing to shooting was probably about a month.
And how long into that did it take you to stop kind of laughing to yourself every time you had to say competitive endurance tickling?
Oh, that wears off pretty quickly. You know, the whole concept was funny for a while, but I mean, this sort of took over our lives in a way of, you know, certainly for Dylan and I. And when you look at anything for long enough, any sort of humor, I think, starts to disappear. And when by the time we were in America, on our second trip, it wasn't particularly funny. But, you know, we're New Zealanders, we try and keep light-hearted about things. We just find other things to laugh about on the journey.
Now, is this... I'm trying to think of a way to phrase this question, because this film gets very dark in a way. And as you said, you know, you're being threatened. There's a general sense of great antagonism coming off of this subject that you've decided to pursue. Is this, like, the greatest 180 that you've ever experienced? You begin thinking that you're just going to look up some stuff on competitive endurance.
Oh, totally. Oh, completely. You know, I've never experienced... I mean, we've all done sort of deep dives onto the internet and sort of discovered things that we didn't expect. But this, you know, it definitely took a turn. I mean, you know, when I first saw the videos, I was like, this is like a weirder thing than Ultimate Frisbee. You know, it's competitive tickling. And then pretty quickly you sort of go, okay, this is some sort of fetishy sort of content. But, you know, I didn't assume it would, you know, as dark as it got. And just the scale of the tickling, you know, how widespread it was, the number of lives affected, that blew me away. And, I mean, if you told me at the beginning of this I was going to be facing, you know, a couple of lawsuits and stuff, I don't know what I'd say, really. But I probably wouldn't believe it. And, you know, I've spent the last 10 years sort of poking around the internet and into sort of weird parts of pop culture, but I never saw this coming.
And off of that, where do you go from here? What do you foresee yourself being able to do that would kind of top unmasking this multi-million-dollar conspiracy? Or do you even want to know how you could possibly do that? Because obviously this was a big surprise. I can only imagine what the surprise that could outdo this would be.
Yeah, I mean, I've never planned anything in my life, really. I've just kind of gone along with what interesting things seem to be interesting at the time, whether it's in the field of journalism or filmmaking or just whatever. So, no, I don't really think about life that way. I mean, it's something else will happen. It will either be, you know, less exciting, as exciting, or more exciting, and I'll just sort of go where things take me. I don't sort of have a big goal of going, right, I've got to get online, I've got to start, you know, I've got to find something stranger or more intense than this. I'll just, you know, I've got no control over that. I'll just see what happens.
Yeah, trying to find something stranger or more intense than this. I mean, has it colored in any way that you look at some of the stranger side of life stories that you do?
Oh, in a way. I mean, I think, you always wonder, you know, what's behind something you've seen. So, I mean, we've all been there, like, we've seen something on the internet, right? And it seems a bit weird. And you kind of poke around a bit and you just sort of move on because that's how life works. You know, you get distracted by something, work or family or a TV show. But, you know, there'll be infinite worlds out there of things that go way deeper than that strange ad you see on Facebook or, you know, something like that. And I think this is just one that we happen to poke and it happened to sort of poke back and we end up where we are now.
In that way, I mean, pardon me, in that way, people have taken to sort of comparing this documentary to Catfish, which was a documentary that raised a lot of questions about the verisimilitude of the actual journey.
Don't even start with that.
I swear I'm not going to harp on it too much.
No, it's fine.
The question becomes, and this is what I wanted to say about it, is people are like, well, how did this one person happen to stumble upon this story? And I think that something that a lot of people don't think of is that, especially in your case, I mean, you seek things like this out. So do you think that there's anything in particular about the character of journalists or filmmakers that kind of makes them more open to being able to glance beyond the surface and not only think to look deeper, but actually have the follow through?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, in a very practical sense, we just have time. I mean, my job is to find things out about something. So, you know, just from that perspective, I think, you know, it just gives us a huge advantage. And I mean, I am just curious about things, but at the same time, a huge part of this was luck. You know, if they hadn't sort of replied with that crazy response, then I might have moved on and I wouldn't have kept digging just for the sake of digging. So yeah, it seems like a huge coincidence, but you know, if I hadn't found it, maybe someone else would have, or maybe, you know, no one else would have. I mean, this Jane O'Brien had been run for 3 years. That was sort of, you'd think it'd be plenty of time for someone to kind of dig in and have a look around. But obviously maybe Jane never reacted in the way that she did to me. And she happened to have that particular, be in that particular mood on that particular day and replied with that particular comment. So, you know, but I mean, the Catfish thing, I mean, it's interesting because obviously Catfish is raising an example of something that, you know, that's very constructed. And I really loved Catfish, and I still remember watching that trailer in New Zealand when it first came out and just being blown away and just desperately wanting to see this film. So what was my point? Oh, no, a lot of people bring up Catfish, but it's, I'd just say that I guess, ours is what happened, in the order it happened, but a lot of people, I think, find it hard to get their heads around.
Yeah, I agree, because there's just this kind of sense of, well, how could this one person have found this, and ooh, they happen to be someone who's a storyteller, and I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, there's something inherent in the character of a person who goes into that profession that's going to make them find things like this. And at a certain point, people just start bringing them to you. And
yeah, completely. And, you know, since the film's come out, people are bringing more stories to me, you know. So the more your knowns are telling stories, I guess the more people are going to reach you with their strange stories, which could eventually lead somewhere.
Well, did you see the Grand Budapest Hotel?
I did.
There's that opening with Tom Wilkinson, where he says basically that.
Yeah, exactly. And funnily enough, that was sort of part of our lookbook when we were sort of thinking of how we'd shoot this thing was Grand Budapest, just with the way a lot of the shots were big and wide and centered. I mean, who isn't looking to Wes Anderson for a bit of inspiration? But we really enjoyed that film.
That is an interesting way to shoot a documentary, though.
Yeah, we just wanted to, I mean, we're in a lot of places that have been seen. We're shooting in New York and we're shooting in these different places, and we just wanted things to be shot in a slightly different way. So our DP, Don Fryer, I think did a pretty bloody good job.
So is that weird when you're chasing this, you know, nation, almost globe-spanning conspiracy, and at the same time you have to sort of take a moment to think about shot composition and how things are going to edit together?
Oh, yeah, I mean, completely. I mean, it was very frustrating because a lot of the time I'd be onto the next interview or contact, and, you know, and Dylan would be the same way, and then we'd have to be go, okay, now we actually have to, like, spend a day in the park shooting some, shooting some coverage for various things, you know. And, you know, we're always looking for, you know, sort of images of predators and that kind of thing to kind of, I mean, some pretty heavy-handed metaphors are in the film, and we know, so we had to spend time sort of walking around looking for things, and, you know, it just takes, I wanted to be on to the next plot point, but we had to stop to shoot some traffic, you know?
Did that ever become frustrating, or did it actually help you to, like, kind of step back, take a minute?
Oh, no, I mean, it was good. I mean, we had a pretty good system when, it was a very small team, so when we were shooting, there was time to do other things as well, start, you know, planning forward, whether it was a very practical thing of booking the next hotel or lining up contacts or locations for interviews. It was all very, you know, there were four of us and it was very, you know, we all were pretty busy full time. So yeah, stopping for half a day or a day to shoot some covering shots was just good time to do other things as well.
Because one of the things that a lot of people ask about documentaries is this something that needed to be in the film format? Pretty much every time a documentary comes out, people say, oh, it was great, but would it have been just as good as like a New Yorker long read? And I think And I think one of the things that actually suits your film is that this could come off as an incredibly absurd, ridiculous, and in the end kind of pointless and meaningless crisis and conspiracy that you found until you start listening to the people who've been affected and you see the kind of emotional toll that this entire thing has taken on them. And I think
we need to see into people's eyes at times. You need to meet these people. And you know, we took a trip just to sort of research this first and meet a lot of these people and figure out, you know, what they were like. And we were very lucky in that they were all very well spoken and were really, like, just really good characters. And we just wanted to, you know, you want to see them and you want to see how they look and breathe and talk and all that stuff. So, you know, plus just Tickling is a very visual. We were very lucky because it's not really a film about Tickling, but Tickling's a very good visual in. And, you know, I always sort of found it amusing that there hasn't been any kind of documentary or even, like, you know, a little scientific, you know, 20-minute show about, you know, what is tickling and why, you know, why are we ticklish? And, you know, it doesn't exist. And so I think, you know, showing some of that stuff visually was kind of fun, and I was kind of glad we were first in.
That is true, because I just had a daughter, and as a person with a child, and just remembering back to my own childhood, tickling is a huge part of it. For some reason, it's like the universal
experience. Yeah, totally. Everyone has been tickled. Like, everyone can identify with that, and, you know, there's this extended scene in the film, which I think... I don't think you're a reviewer from your site. I think they were the ones that really didn't like it. But it was, you know, everyone reacts in a different way because everyone's been tickled and everyone has that immediate, it's not like a foreign thing. So people have like a very visceral response when they're watching someone being tickled. They're either like liking it, hating it. They find it funny. They find it funny for a while. Then they find it awkward. Like the reactions at that moment are quite interesting to watch.
It's weird because it's such a bizarrely intimate interaction that has an expression that is so public that some people end up not being able to breathe afterwards.
Completely. Yeah, totally. And it's, you know, you're sort of in pain, but you're laughing. Like it's a very odd phenomenon.
And it's strange how well you could attach the metaphor of tickling to the, not just the act of watching this documentary, but pretty much what the documentary is about. Something very private and strange that somehow ripples outwards and just alters everything around.
Completely. Yeah, totally. There are a lot of fun little metaphors within the, you know, tickling itself. You know, and here's the other one, is just someone having power and control over someone else. You know, someone is dominant over someone else, and that kind of rippled out into the bigger kind of picture that we saw with the whole doco.
One of the things that you'd mentioned previously that I wanted to touch on was how, if you hadn't gotten this Facebook message back, if they perhaps had been in a better mood and just said, oh, we're busy, this never would have happened. Is that thought
no.
terrifying to you because of everything that you uncovered and all the people you found whose lives have been touched by this tickling ring?
Oh, no. I mean, I like that aspect of life. I love that randomness of things. And, you know, a lot of my life is kind of, not to make this about me, but like a lot of my life has kind of taken that turn. Like I really haven't planned anything, and things have just sort of happened. And this is just an extreme version of that. So I find it, I love it, because you're like, you know, what's going to happen next? You know, what other things are out there to discover? I find it pretty stimulating and pretty interesting.
It's just, I ask because there was a point right after the film had finished, and I was sitting there and I just thought, my God, if that one thing hadn't happened, you know, if a million things in the course of this hadn't happened, there'd still be this thing, but none of us would know about it. And it's the type of Lovecraftian conspiracy that makes the world a little more interesting, but a little more horrifying.
Completely. And, you know, it is, you know, when you think of the number of things that are, you know, potentially things going on in the world that are much worse that we have no, you know, no idea about and will remain unexposed unless someone pokes in the right place. I mean, that is terrifying. But, you know, hopefully it just stimulates people to look at a little bit closer if they see something and to try and poke around. And, you know, there's people online now poking around further into this whole tickling world, and they're finding out their own things. So I think that's really great.
Yeah, you really got the ball rolling on that. Is there anything that you would say to people who were interested in doing that, in poking around more? Any pearls of wisdom that you could grant them?
Oh, I think, you know, it depends where you're poking and what your skill set is. But I think just don't get distracted and just keep poking. You know, there's you can just look at things for, you know, you can read through something, you know, 10, 12, 13 times, but, you know, the 14th time something will click. And you'll find a link, or you'll recognize something. You just got to be thorough and really engaged. But, you know, that'll just happen organically when you find a topic that interests you. You know, you can't force that. And just take really good notes, keep records of things, because, you know, if it's, you know, when it starts, you're kind of frantic. But, you know, 2 years down the line, it's really handy to have a little spreadsheet or a little shared Google Doc where you can dial back in and see when things happened and how they happened. And, you know, just keep very good notes. If your investigation balloons out into something that takes place over multiple years, just keep notes.
Now to that, you know, keeping notes, one of the big turn moments in your documentary is when you go back and look at the websites that have been registered and find that cache of personal data.
Mm.
So did that come out of the note-taking process? I mean, in the movie it plays as this bizarre twist that it's just like impossible to comprehend. So I'm wondering
no, it's crazy. Yeah. No, I mean the way that happened is that, you know, we had found those 300 domain names. Dylan had found them very early on in the process, and we'd gone through all of them and we knew it was there. So we knew there was a directory listing of personal files, but they were all password protected. And it was very frustrating through the whole process because, you know, all this evidence. So, like, you know, imagine you've got the hard drive of, you know, the main subject, this hidden character of your documentary. You have that hard drive, but you can't open anything. That's how we felt the whole way through. You know, there was stuff in there that just from the file names we could tell would help us prove certain things. So each day I'd click and see if it had opened. And it never did. And then we see that in the documentary, we clicked and all these private files were suddenly not password protected anymore. And I called Dylan and he downloaded them. So it seems completely ridiculous, but, you know, at some point he'd switched servers and the permissions dropped off and we got access to those files. So, you know, in the film, it seems unbelievable. It seemed pretty unbelievable to us as well at the time.
How do you even react to something like that? I mean,
I was excited. I was ecstatic. I was terrified that it was going to be open for 10 seconds and we'd miss it. It was just this real, it was utterly bizarre, because it was something we never thought would happen. And then it did happen. And, you know, it's another one of those moments, you know, if we didn't have those documents, it would be questionable. You know, the documentary would take a different shape because we didn't have proof. We had a lot of things that we, you know, were very sure were real, but, you know, until we proved it, we couldn't just put this out there in the world. So again, without that happening, the film would be a different film. There might not even be a film. You know, we may not have been able to, you know, prove enough that we'd found out or suspected without that happening. So it's just another example of chance, fate. I don't know. I have no idea. It just is something that happened.
Now to that, one of the last things I want to ask you about is there were so many times in this film where it seemed as though you'd hit a dead end and then something would happen. You'd take another tact and then things would open up. And through it all, as I said earlier, this has a very 70s conspiracy thriller kind of vibe to it, minus the person who, like, throws their fist into a wall or overturns a table saying, you know, you're not getting anywhere fast enough. How do you maintain, I don't want to say like your upbeat attitude, but like your optimism, and you never have that kind of meltdown moment that in a Hollywood movie precipitates, you know, someone throwing a baseball through a picture frame and finding like a bank account number.
I probably had a few moments over those 2 years where I probably punched a couple of pillows or something on the bed, you know, in frustration or annoyance. But no, I'm just personally, I'm a fairly optimistic, happy person, and I am a reasonably calm person. So yeah, that's just the way I react to things. And you know, Dylan and I wanted to take a fairly calm approach through the whole film because, you know, we're up against such ludicrous stuff that was just so out of this world, whether it was the personal attacks or the legal threats or just the subject matter. You know, we kind of had to just keep level. If our emotions were spiking too much, it would just become untenable, you know, unworkable making this. You know, there was so much madness coming from the other side. We wanted to keep sort of calm and control. But it's also, it's a very New Zealand thing. I mean, in New Zealand, you've probably watched Flight of the Conchords and stuff. Like, that's not far off the way we are in New Zealand. Like, we don't get that excited, or, you know, we're quite flat, I think. And we don't, it's just kind of the way we are. So it's not a unique thing to me or to Dylan. It's just sort of, it's a bit of a New Zealand, it's sort of bred into us, I think.
Because I don't want to, you know, it's a documentary, it's real life, but it is structured and told as a story. So it is an interesting story purely because we're so used to seeing, you know, the angry and the cynical private eye sort of archetype. And this whole documentary is just a subversion of that in a way, because yeah, you're really just happy to be here and keeping.
Well, yeah, I was saying that I always, yeah, it's just the way. You know, Dylan and I were both very curious people as well, and I think we were just, you know, we're a couple of New Zealanders curious about a thing, and we just end up on this very surreal American road trip that goes to some stranger places than we thought it would. And that's what you're seeing on film, and I think most people seem to appreciate that. Some people think it's all made up. But it's been really interesting, you know, the reactions to it and what people have to say.
Was there ever a point where you kind of wanted to add more of that fish out of water culture story, or did you feel like that would detract or give?
Yeah, not really. I mean, we showed, you know, a few kind of shots of sort of where we live in New Zealand, and it's, you know, there's some quite sort of you know, it's a fairly relaxed environment we're in. I mean, I live quite close to the water. Dylan's in a really beautiful bit of suburbia with his family. So we wanted to show a little bit of that before we got into the sort of the, into downtown Los Angeles and Times Square and those sort of places. So it just sort of organically happened that way. We didn't want to push anything too far, really. Yeah.
All right. Well, it is a fantastic, utterly baffling documentary. And for all of the chances that you took and for all of the weird, quirky twists of fate and chance, it's really spectacular. And carving this narrative out of what I can only assume was a lot of footage and information, it's a very impressive achievement. So congratulations on the film, and thank you so much for talking to me.
No, thanks for chatting. It's been a strange journey, and yeah, I hope people can enjoy it.
as a final parting gift, can you tell us what you're working on next?
I'm dealing with a lot of tickles related matters at the moment, but I'm working on a couple of ideas of other docs, sort of early stages there, but just, you know, just still trying to be curious about things, but can't say too much at this stage.
So that was our interview with co-director of Tickled, David Ferrier. Hopefully you enjoyed it. Hopefully it was informative and hilarious and all of the things you've come to expect from the show. Again, rate us on iTunes, give us a star rating, give us a comment. Find us on Twitter at Filmstage Show, and find us on Facebook, The Filmstage Show. We'd love to hear from you, and we'd love to hear what you thought of the interview. So thank you again, ladies and gentlemen. Look for regular episodes in your feed soon. I am Brian J. Rowan, and I look forward to speaking to you next time.